This is CBC News.
Good evening. I'm Dwight Smith.
And I'm Allison Smith. This is The World at 6.
Tonight, did Raheem Jaffer lie?
Mr. Jaffer seemed to state to this committee last week that he ended our relationship months ago. This was untrue.
Nazim Galani details his business dealings with the former MP.
Up in smoke.
The habitats we have along the coastline are considered one of the most sensitive habitats.
Crews set fire to the growing oil slick in the Gulf of Mexico.
And caught on tape.
It's a disaster. Ugh, everything. She's just this old bigoted woman.
A live microphone deepens the troubles of British Prime Minister Gordon Brown. That's coming up later. But first, Allison has our top story.
4 weeks, allegations have been swirling around the Toronto businessman at the center of the Raheem Jaffer affair. Well, today, Nazim Galani got to tell his side of the story. And he says just about everything you've heard or read about him is false, including some sworn statements from the former MP. Allison Crawford has the story from Ottawa.
Nazim Galani delivered an angry opening statement where he ripped apart much of last week's testimony by his ex-business associate, former MP Raheem Jaffer. Practically spitting out every word, the CEO of International Strategic Investments provided MPs with copies of a contract dated September 21, 2009, between himself and Jaffer's company, Green Power Generation.
This date should be compared to testimony last week when the principals of GPG said there were no synergies with ISI and that they ended their relationship with me.
Here's what Jaffer told the committee when he testified a week ago.
We realized very quickly after a few meetings with him that our firms were very divergent, that we had no real synergies that we could develop a relationship, and so that exploration ended at that stage.
Galani says the relationship never fizzled last fall. Rather, he and Jaffer were scheduled to take a business trip together this very month.
Further, Mr. Jaffer and I were to travel to China together on April 13, 2010. Yet Mr. Jaffer seemed to state to this committee last week that he ended our relationship months ago. This was untrue.
Galani says he hired Jaffer to help him navigate the twisted maze of government bureaucracy in search of funding for environmental projects. As members of the same ethnic community, Galani says he and Jaffer trusted each other to sort out payments later. Liberal MP Marcel Proulx says that's a curious business practice.
That contract shows that down the road, had they been successful, there would have been a récompense, there would have been a retribution, they would have charged something. So this is illegal.
The committee learned more about another curious business practice today. Galani confirmed reports that at a meeting last summer, Jaffer handed out his old MP business cards, albeit with the MP part crossed out, something Jaffer denied last week. NDP MP Pat Martin says after Galani's testimony, the committee wants to ask Jaffer more questions.
He was helpful in that he pointed out that Raheem Jaffer sat there and lied to our committee over and over and over again.
As for Galani, he says the media maelstrom has cost him 4 lucrative business contracts and broken the engagement with his fiancée. While he refused to answer reporters' questions today, he promised interviews in the future and left Parliament Hill in a black Cadillac. Allison Crawford, CBC News, Ottawa.
And new documents released late today reveal even more about former MP Raheem Jaffer's attempts to land government contracts. The correspondence shows Jaffer used his wife's parliamentary email account to reach out to officials. Helena Georges was the Minister for the Status of Women at the time. The emails show Jaffer was promoting projects with the offices of the Minister of Public Works, the Secretary of State for Science and Technology, as well as the Environment and Transport Departments. The email exchange has now been sent to the Lobbying Commissioner and the Ethics Commissioner.
The countdown is on. One day after the Speaker of the House of Commons gave the government and the opposition 2 weeks to compromise on the release of Afghan detainee documents. Yesterday, Peter Milliken ruled that Parliament does have the power to demand access to the sensitive material. Today, the Prime Minister repeated the government's argument that releasing the documents could break the laws passed by Parliament. Louise Elliott reports.
In question period, Liberal leader Michael Ignatieff asked Prime Minister Stephen Harper to acknowledge the Speaker's ruling.
Does he now understand that the ultimate decision to invoke national security to prevent the disclosure of documents, that decision rests with this House, with the elected
representatives. Harper did, but he also sounded a note of warning.
We look forward to both complying with your ruling and with the legal obligations that have been established by statutes passed by this Parliament. And Mr. Speaker,
Harper was apparently referring to the government's argument that it can't release the documents without violating several laws, including the Canada Evidence Act. But Milliken found against that argument yesterday. He says Parliament's power to subpoena information is absolute. An angry opposition says Harper isn't playing ball. NDP defence critic Jack Harris.
The Prime Minister has definitely signalled that there will not be the kind of cooperation that the Speaker's ruling demands. So we'll see if that changes. But it looks like to me a very strong signal from the Prime Minister that the will of Parliament will not be carried out.
Ignatieff suggested he's open to expanding the role of former Supreme Court Justice Frank Iacobucci, who's now sifting through documents at the government's request.
Were you to have a situation in which Justice Iacobucci essentially reports to Parliament and has sworn MPs examining the documents, that is a possible solution.
A solution to make sure opposition MPs get enough information while allowing Iacobucci to shield them from information that would make it difficult to challenge the government. Constitutional expert Ned Franks argues that with too much classified information, MPs would be hindered.
It puts a terrible burden on the members of Parliament whose main mode of action is to talk and speak in public and to look for an audience in the public.
A source in the Prime Minister's office today maintained the Prime Minister is open to discussions about a compromise. But the source also says Harper needs some kind of assurance that MPs won't leak sensitive information. Louise Elliott, CBC News, Ottawa.
The U.S. Coast Guard has set fire to that huge oil spill off the coast of Louisiana. Officials say it's the best of a number of bad choices. They believe they can save the ecologically fragile coasts if the growing oil slick can be burned. As David Common tells us, environmentalists are opposed to the plan, but they're hardly supportive either.
From the sky, the extent of this spill is evident, quickly approaching Louisiana's coast. That burning the floating oil to eliminate it has now become the preferred option underscores how much fear there is of what Coast Guard Admiral Mary Landry calls the alternative.
We have come a long way and we are much more prepared than we were when the Exxon Valdez occurred.
The oil continues to surface by tens of thousands of liters each day, released when the oil rig Deepwater Horizon exploded and then sank last week. Crews have been unable to activate a shutoff valve underwater. The rig's operator, British Petroleum, is building a dome to cap the leak, but that could take a month. So dozens of vessels are deploying boom trying to contain the spill, which is already very close to outlying islands, including vast wetlands and a major wildlife sanctuary, says coastal geologist John Lopez.
The habitats we have along the coastline are considered one of the most sensitive habitats. Certainly with waterfowl, oiled birds, the rate of recovery, even with the best efforts, is not good. I believe it's probably less than 50%. So if birds get oiled, there's a good chance that they will die.
Shrimp and oyster dealers worry their livelihoods could be destroyed, so they largely support the burn-off. And Louisa Wood of the UN World Conservation Monitoring Center says igniting the oil offshore is likely much cheaper than cleaning oil off birds and beaches.
The local agency is doing a kind of cost-benefit analysis of the various potential impacts of the different options available to them.
Burning comes with dangers to sea life and will release black plumes of polluting smoke. The episode comes just weeks after the White House announced a planned expansion of offshore drilling. Louisiana alone has some 4,000 rigs. David Common, CBC News, New York.
I'm Leslie McLaren in Winnipeg, where commuters didn't hesitate this morning when they saw a woman threatening to jump off a bridge. CBC's traffic reporter saw the whole thing.
I watched the woman kind of dip down a couple times because she had one foot on the bridge while holding onto the rail and the other foot hanging in the air.
A busload of Good Samaritans coming up on The World at 6.
There are more signs the financial crisis in Europe is spreading. Spain's credit rating has been slashed just a day after Portugal and Greece were downgraded. Greece is teetering on the brink of financial collapse. Without a bailout, it could default on its debt next month. And as we hear from our economics reporter Mike Hornbrook, there are fears the trouble could reach beyond the eurozone.
On the streets of Athens, gloom.
I expect nothing, just bankruptcy. I think it's inevitable. As I work in finance, I believe that unfortunately there's nothing else besides this.
Greece says it cannot pay debts that are coming due in a few weeks without a huge bailout. Ken Watford, a senior economist with BNP Paribas in London, says there's danger the panic may spread.
What really concerns me is the contagion effects to other markets and other countries, particularly stock markets. If they keep on falling, the effects there would spill over from financial markets to the real economy, and that could cause some damage to the economic recovery at a very fragile stage, way beyond just the problems in Greece.
The contagion hit Spain today and could hit other countries like Italy, Ireland, perhaps even Britain, also heavily in debt and running a huge budget deficit. The Secretary General of the OECD, Angel Guerrera, is calling for quick action.
It's not the question of the danger of contagion. Contagion has already happened. This is like Ebola. When you realize you have it, you have to cut your leg off in order to survive. And it's already having very deleterious impacts in the markets.
There was hope that a $60 billion aid package agreed by Eurozone nations for Greece would stem the panic. But Germany continues to drag its feet, insisting that Greece needs to do more to get its house in order. Regional elections are 10 days away, and a bailout is very unpopular with German voters.
They were irresponsible with spending. Now it's Greece, but it could be a domino effect, taking down Portugal, Spain, and Italy after. They were irresponsible.
There was no spillover into Canada today, but yesterday, when Greek bonds were downgraded to junk, there was a big sell-off in commodities, the TSX tumbled, and the loonie fell. Despite that, Carl Weinberg, the chief economist for high-frequency economics, says Canada should not be seriously impacted by troubles in the Eurozone.
There's no way you can extrapolate Canada's very, very strong fiscal position into anything at all remotely like what we're seeing in Southern Europe. Canada has the strongest fiscal position of any of the developed market economies right now.
The big concern is, what if the contagion spreads to the United States, which will run a $1 trillion deficit this year? So far, there's no sign of that happening yet. Mike Hornbrook, CBC News, Toronto.
The news that Europe's debt crisis has spread to Spain took a bite out of the Toronto stock market. The TSX shed 70 points to close at 12,077. On Wall Street, markets climbed after the U.S. Federal Reserve said it would hold interest rates at record lows for an extended period. The Dow Jones added 53 points. The Nasdaq edged up marginally. And the loonie gained about 0.9% to close at 99.13 cents U.S.
It's been a bad, bad day on the campaign trail for British Prime Minister Gordon Brown. Just a week before the election and one day before a televised debate, an open microphone caught Brown calling a widow who had approached him earlier on the street a bigot. Thomas Ledwell has more from London.
It's a nice area, isn't it?
My family have voted Labour all their life.
Pensioner Gillian Duffy speaks with Gordon Brown on a campaign stop in the hotly contested riding of Rochdale near Manchester. Labour has encouraged Brown to have more face-to-face time with real voters to show his softer side.
Don't say anything about the immigrants because you're saying that but all these Eastern Europeans what are coming in, where are they flocking from?
A million people come from here, but a million...
Duffy complained about immigration, the deficit, and taxes. Brown was patient and understanding, and the discussion appeared to end well. But safely inside his car, Brown changed his tune. A wireless microphone attached to his jacket caught his critical remarks.
It's a disaster. Everything. She's just this all bigoted woman.
It wasn't long before Brown heard the recording. It was played for him live during a BBC interview. He sat listening with his head in his hands. Meanwhile, Duffy, the lifelong Labour supporter, was stunned to hear the remarks.
I can't believe this, that he said that. All my life's been done by Labour.
Duffy says she asked the Prime Minister exactly the kind of questions ordinary voters want answered. With disgust, she told reporters she did not want an apology, but she got two, one on the phone and one in person, after Brown rushed back to Duffy's home. He emerged 45 minutes later.
I'm mortified by what's happened. I've given her my sincere apologies. I misunderstood what she said, and she has accepted that there was a misunderstanding, and she's accepted my apology. If you like, I'm a penitent sinner.
Nick Cohen is a political commentator with the Observer newspaper.
He got it wrong. It's embarrassing. It's cringeably embarrassing and damaging to him. But he went and faced up the lady and explained it and apologised. That's what he should have done.
Still, the gaffe could be costly. Labour has been lagging in the polls from the beginning of the campaign and has been hoping for a game changer. Brown's shot in the foot may hurt his already shaky public image, and on the eve of a crucial third and final leaders' debate, the game may well have changed, but not as Brown had hoped. Thomas Ledwell, CBC News, London.
In Guantanamo Bay, lawyers for Omar Khadr are moving to have his confessions ruled inadmissible when he goes to trial this summer. The 23-year-old Canadian is accused of war crimes, including espionage and murdering an American soldier in Afghanistan. As our security correspondent Bill Gillespie reports from Cuba, his lawyers also say a plea bargain is in the works.
Today, Omar Khadr's new high-powered Washington attorney, Barry Coburn, took center stage.
Let's remember that Mr. Khadr was 15 years old.
When the hearing finally got underway, the defense and the prosecution began wrangling over what witnesses will be allowed to testify at his trial. He'll also target the most damaging evidence against Khadr, self-incriminating statements he made to U.S. military and CIA interrogators. Colburn claims they were wrung out of his then 15-year-old client under torture. In addition, Colburn will argue that military commissions don't have the legal right to try a child soldier, a claim that cuts no ice with prosecution spokesperson Captain David Iglesias.
As a former U.S. attorney, I authorize prosecution of teenagers all the time.
In the coming weeks, the military prosecutors will bring several interrogators to the stand. They'll testify they didn't lay a hand on Khadr. Meanwhile, a more important story may be unfolding behind the scenes. Barry Coburn says negotiations are underway on a plea bargain. If a deal can be hammered out, Khadr will avoid a trial and a possible life sentence. That would put the ball back in Prime Minister Stephen Harper's court. Harper has promised that once the U.S. legal process is over, he'll decide whether or not he'll ask the Americans to send Khadr back to Canada. Bill Gillespie, CBC News, Guantanamo Bay.
Lawyers for a controversial British MP say the idea to ban him from entering Canada came from the Jewish Defense League. George Galloway was told last year he wouldn't be allowed in Canada. His lawyers told a federal court hearing today in Toronto that the ban was not about national security, but politics. Philip Leshanick reports.
I don't understand why Canada wants to tear up its reputation, lose its baby face, and become a killer like the rest of them. You're killing people in Afghanistan, they're killing you, and you're making people hate you. That's not wise politics.
George Galloway's brand of politics, his outspoken opposition to Canada's role in Afghanistan and its support of Israel. His lawyer, Hadiyat Nizami, says those are the real reasons Galloway is banned from Canada. But he says the elected British MP is not a security threat.
They don't see him as a threat. This provision is meant to safeguard us against threats, national security threats. There is no such threat. If there was, CSIS would be dealing with it.
Galloway led a well-publicized aid convoy to Palestinians in Gaza last year. Because the area is ruled by Hamas, he says any international humanitarian aid has to go through that organization, which is on Canada's list of banned terrorist groups. Nizami told a federal court that a letter from the Jewish Defense League of Canada to Citizenship and Immigration Minister Jason Kenney got the ball rolling. The letter spurred a flurry of emails between Kenney's office and the Canadian Border Services Agency. A few hours later, Galloway was declared inadmissible, shortly before he was scheduled to speak in Toronto. Mayor Weinstein, the national director of the Jewish Defense League, says he sent the letter.
I have more than a right to send a letter to the government expressing my concern about an individual who raises funds for terror organizations.
A lawyer for the government says that while Galloway was not allowed to enter Canada, he was still able to deliver his message by video conference, so the rights of Canadians were not infringed by keeping him out. A federal judge must now decide if it was legal for the government to ban Galloway. He has reserved that decision. Philip Leshanock, CBC News, Toronto.
Canada's public safety minister has put a price tag on one aspect of the government's criminal justice legislation. Vic Taves says the so-called Truth in Sentencing Law will cost $2 billion over the next 5 years. It eliminates reduced sentences for prisoners who spend time in pre-sentence custody, so more people will be behind bars for longer periods of time. Taves refused to say how much the government's entire law and order agenda will cost.
G8 development ministers in meeting in Halifax have agreed to a set of principles for the Canadian-led initiative on maternal health. And they maintain there is no conflict, even over the thorny issue of abortion. Stephen Puddicombe reports.
We have agreed on a set of principles that will guide our work.
Canada's Minister of International Cooperation, Bev Oda, says this agreement has flexibility.
Each country can advise their leaders on how to build their basket of initiatives to support Canada's focus on mothers and children.
In other words, every G8 member can pick and choose their own initiatives when it comes to maternal and child health in developing countries. This allows Canada to refuse to fund abortions while letting other G8 members, like the United States, support abortion without there being any conflict between the two. This worries Yolanta Scott-Parker. She's the executive director of the Canadian Federation for Sexual Health. It's affiliated with the International Planned Parenthood Federation. She says Canada has adopted a piecemeal or menu approach to reproductive health,
where there's a sense that we can choose the pieces of comprehensive sexual reproductive health that we would like to support and invest in internationally and opt out of others, which, you know, is not really in keeping with the global consensus.
The head of the International Planned Parenthood Federation is also surprised by the position Canada has taken on abortion in developing countries. Jill Greer says Canada has always been very supportive of reproductive health services, and she hopes that will continue.
I think that probably the Canadian government would want to see women internationally able to access the same kinds of services that women can in their own country, in Canada.
Canada has supported the International Planned Parenthood Federation for half a century, but the group has not heard if it will get funding this year. Stephen Puddicombe, CBC News, Halifax.
RCMP and Penticton have solved a mystery spanning nearly 40 years. They've identified human remains discovered in a car that was dragged from Skaha Lake on Sunday. Investigators say the remains are those of a 20-year-old woman who disappeared in 1972. They're relying on the woman's paper ID that was still intact, even though it was submerged for so long. RCMP says it was unlikely an accident that sent the car over. It was an accident that sent the car over a cliff and into the lake.
Earlier this week, we reported on the death of a homeless man in New York who had defended a woman being attacked, only to be attacked himself. Several people walked by the injured man, who eventually died. Well, today, a Good Samaritan story out of Winnipeg with a happier ending. And it involves not just one Good Samaritan, but several. Leslie McLaren reports.
Winnipeg's Osborne Street Bridge. It gets some pretty heavy traffic. CBC's traffic reporter Ismaila Alpha keeps a close eye on it with live traffic cameras.
I was initially looking for traffic problems.
But what he saw at 7 this morning was shocking. A woman hanging over the railing, the murky Assiniboine River below.
I watched the woman kind of dip down a couple times because she had one foot on the bridge while holding onto the rail and the other foot hanging in the air.
Alpha says a bus stopped and the driver and others got out and pulled her to safety.
It was really easy to see because she's wearing white shoes and everybody was wearing black and two white shoes just up and over the rail. And that was it. It was all over.
The union that represents bus drivers says, in fact, it was the driver and two other city transit employees heading into work who initially stopped the bus. Other passengers followed. Rickert speaks for the Amalgamated Transit Union.
The reaction time was really critical in this incident, and they were there at the right time to save this person's life.
Winnipeg police say everyone did the right thing. Constable Jason Mikulishan.
People in the area reacted appropriately, took it upon themselves to approach her and maybe ask questions and at one point possibly even restrain her so that she would remain safe.
The woman is in hospital, but she's alive.
I think that's incredible. I think it's just such an amazing story of people looking after people.
Lindsay Pollock walks on this bridge every day.
It's nice to know that complete strangers will help you in your biggest time of need.
I guess you're surprised, but we have that a lot.
Colleen Hogue has been driving buses in Winnipeg for 24 years. She says, sadly, this is nothing new.
We've had a few other drivers, prevent people from committing suicide. And actually, it's usually this bridge.
Hogue says it's just a good thing that people take the time to help. Leslie McLaren, CBC News, Winnipeg.
You're listening to The World at 6 on CBC Radio 1.
We're on the internet at cbcnews.ca.
The most coveted award in international sports has touched down on Canadian soil. The FIFA World Cup trophy is touring the globe in the run-up to the soccer tournament. Today it arrived in Toronto, and the CBC's Teddy Katz was there for the unveiling.
African drummers and dancers were on hand to greet the trophy when it arrived at the airport in Toronto today.
Let's unveil for the first time ever in Canada the official FIFA World Cup trophy.
Sherazad Suhail was one of thousands of fans who came out to the CBC Broadcasting Center to see the 18-karat gold treasure and to get his picture taken with it.
The World Cup is the biggest single-sport event on Earth, and to see the trophy live in Canada is an amazing opportunity you can't pass up on.
Joe, you got to take a picture of me after. Sammy, you're blocking it.
The trophy is carefully protected in a glass display case. Brian Chenoa of FIFA is keeping an eye on everything. You see, the average person can't get too close to the trophy.
The only people you have to should get to touch the trophy, very important heads of state and very important World Cup winners. It's a very valuable trophy, so it's not like something you could pass around, not to use the Stanley Cup, but you can't pour beer on it and things like that.
This is the second incarnation of the trophy. The first was stolen on two different occasions. Now it's under lock and key most of the time, with heavy security guarding it 24 hours a day. When it's not on the road, the trophy is kept in an undisclosed location in Zurich. Juno Award-winning musician Kanon sings the anthem for the trophy tour, which is going to 86 countries. Kanon was born in Somalia, but grew up in Toronto, and is disappointed it wasn't safe enough to go to his homeland.
And so it's bittersweet for me, because, you know, I'm going around with the trophy and taking it to every part of the world, but can't go home. If I couldn't take it home, it's nice to take it to my other home.
The trophy will stay in North America for a couple of days. Then it starts the long trek back to South Africa, where the World Cup begins in June. And 32 teams can't wait to get their hands on it. Teddy Katz, CBC News, Toronto.
And now to sum up, the Toronto businessman at the center of the Rahim Jaffer affair has his say in Ottawa. Nazim Golani appeared before the same parliamentary committee that grilled Jaffer and his business partner last week. Golani refutes several allegations about himself, including some that the former MP stated under oath.
Burning off a big mess, the U.S. Coast Guard sets fire to that huge oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. The idea is to stop the growing slick before it reaches several hundred kilometers of fragile coastline. Officials call it the best of a number of bad options.
And that's our program for Wednesday, April the 28th.
The World at 6. From CBC National Radio News, I'm Dwight Smith.
And I'm Allison Smith. Have a good night.
Good night.